Tonight is Good Friday in the Christian calendar, and this is a time when Christians think about Jesus Christ and how he died on the cross to save the world. And as Buddhists, we don't have a God that we look to as the creator and as the protector, and we don't have someone who has saved us through their death, like Jesus Christ. So we might reflect, well, what are we getting if we don't have a saviour? And so it's important to reflect on who the Buddha was and what he offers as our teacher, because we understand that the Buddha was a human being. He wasn't a god. He didn't come from heaven to save us through making a great sacrifice. So what did the Buddha offer to us? The Buddha did renounce his worldly life and his life of comfort and pleasure in the palace. So there was an element of sacrifice, and he went into the forest and lived a very hard life to pursue the spiritual life and to find the way out of suffering. And with his enlightenment, he found the cause of suffering and also the path to the end of suffering. So in that sense, he sacrificed, and in that sense, he's also a saviour, because after he found the way out of suffering himself, for himself, he didn't keep that as a secret. He didn't benefit just himself from his understanding. For the next 45 years, he went around India teaching what he had discovered. So you could say that that was also an act of renunciation, because he no longer needed to do that kind of thing for his own happiness or for his own security, but he put himself out to offer his teachings so that others could also find the way out of suffering. But the point is that he could only save himself. And though he gave the teaching, each one of us has to take up that teaching and save ourselves. That's the big difference between religions where there's a God whom you can believe in and through that faith be saved. In Buddhism, even if you believe that the Buddha was enlightened and you agree with his teachings, if you don't practice the path, if you don't change your own way of looking at things and your own behaviour, then you're not going to come to the end of suffering. And it's not that it will be a punishment, it will be a consequence of not having understood things as they really are. So each one of us has to be our own saviour. And that's one of the things in Buddhism that puts people off sometimes, because it means that we have to do the hard work ourselves. But it's a wonderful thing to reflect that we do have the means for our own enlightenment. We have the teaching, we have the capacity, each one of us. We have the very good karma to be in this situation where we have facilities that support our practice. We have the understanding of the teaching, and we have the encouragement to keep on practicing ourselves. The other big difference, or one of the major differences, which I'd just like to highlight tonight, between Buddhism and other religions, is that the Buddha understood the mind. He understood the way we function and what makes us tick. And the wisdom aspect of the Buddhist path is one of the factors which distinguishes it from other religions. Other religions where one is saved through believing in someone or in some teaching. The wisdom factor explained by the Buddha, developed over the course of the years that the Buddha was teaching, explains not only how the mind works, but where we fit in to the world, and the nature of the world itself. But the understanding that the Buddha had was his wisdom, and it's a wisdom which is on quite a different level to the wisdom that we have about life. What we have is a partial picture, and very often a distorted picture. And so the practice that we have to undertake is not only to cultivate wholesome qualities and to make ourselves into better human beings, but also to develop that wisdom factor so that we start to see the world in the way that the Buddha saw it. It means then that we are operating from quite a different perspective in what we are doing in the world, in the way that we are functioning in the world. The wisdom aspect turns our understanding of the world on its head. But again, the beauty is that the Buddha has given us very clear guidelines on how to develop this wisdom factor for ourselves. We don't have to go searching, we don't have to ponder it, we just have to follow the instructions that have been given. So tonight I'd like to specifically deal with one of the aspects which we would be aware of in our ordinary functioning in the life, in our daily life, and that is the power that very strong emotions have over the mind. And the Buddha's explanation of these emotions and also how to deal with them. This teaching comes because the Buddha understood the mind, and not just understood his mind, but understood the mind as it functions in all of us. And the emotions are just one aspect of the way that the Buddha understood the mind as it functions. But our emotions have a very powerful influence on the way we think, speak and act. And any of the powerful emotions like greed, jealousy, hatred can overwhelm us and cause us to say and do things which we later regret and which get us into trouble. And so this is one of the areas of our ordinary life that we have to pay attention to, and we have to do something with if we want to pursue this path. Because one of the effects of having a mind which is overwhelmed by strong emotion is that it impairs our ability to think clearly. When we're overwhelmed by anger, when we're overwhelmed by desire, we say, I couldn't think straight. I was so angry. And this is a very common experience. It doesn't matter whether it's the emotion of based on hatred or an emotion based on greed. When those emotions are playing themselves out very powerfully in the mind, they overwhelm the mind and they make it difficult for us not only to think straight, but to see things clearly, to control our reactions, and to make decisions based on whether this will be for my benefit or for my harm, whether this will be for my benefit or my harm now and in the future, whether this will be for the benefit of others or for the harm of others now or in the future. So we have to start to rein in our powerful emotions. And in Buddhism, we use both aspects of practice. We use both the wisdom aspect and also the calming aspect to try to bring these powerful emotions under our deliberate control. From the wisdom aspect, the Buddha said that we have to start to understand that the emotions that arise within us are arising from within. The trigger for these emotions, the thing that sparks them off, may be something outside ourselves. It may be another person and something they did or said. It may be a situation that we are involved in. But the particular emotion that arises within us will be peculiar to each one of us. We will all have an individual response depending on our conditioning, our habit patterns, what kind of mood we're in, who else is there, whether it's in private or in public, whether it's when we're hungry or when we're tired, when we're in a good mood or a bad mood. Our individual reactions will be what arises within us. And it's not only that the individual emotions will be specific to us, but the way that we perceive a situation so that that situation triggers a reaction within us will also be individual and specific, depending on all of those various causes and conditions. This is the first thing that we have to understand. Otherwise, we think that our emotional reaction is the right one. It's correct. This is the way everyone feels. This must be true because I'm feeling it. So from the wisdom aspect, we have to start to question that. And here's a nice story to help us see how this kind of reaction is produced within us, but differently for each one of us. There was a teacher, a school teacher, who was going to have a baby. And when she found out she was pregnant, she decided that she wanted to have a natural childbirth. She wanted to have a delivery where she didn't have any drugs for the pain. And so she went to all the classes and along with her husband and did all the training so that she could have a drug-free delivery. And when she went to the hospital to be delivered of her child, she saw that one of her classmates was also in the hospital about to give birth. But her classmate had completely the opposite intention. She hadn't done any of the preparation for having the baby. Her idea was as soon as there was any pain, she was going to have whatever drugs they could give her. She wasn't going to suffer when there was something available for her to take. And so the two of them went in to the delivery ward, and the teacher who'd practiced so long and done all the lessons so that she could have a pain-free delivery, went through all of the time of labour without having any of the things that were offered to her, just relying on the training that she'd done and the support of her husband. And finally, she was delivered of her child. But her friend, as soon as there was any discomfort, she took the mild pain relief. And then as it got stronger, she took the stronger pain relief until eventually she was taking whatever was available. And she also was delivered of her child. So as the first teacher who'd put all the effort into having a pain-free delivery was being wheeled out of the delivery room back to the recovery ward, she looked on the notice board that was outside the delivery room and she saw there was her name with a B+ next to it. And there was the name of her friend with an A+ next to it. And she said to her husband, when you look at that, I went to all that trouble, weeks and weeks of training and going to lessons and eating all the right things and not taking any drugs at all during the delivery, and all I got was a B-. And look at that friend of mine. She didn't do any training. She didn't do any preparation. She took every drug that was available to her, and they've given her an A+. And the husband said, "Dear, I think that's your blood group." And certainly it was. Now, any teachers here would probably relate to that. As soon as you see a blackboard and you see a name with a letter next to it, that's a mark for the test. And even the fact that this is perceived as being a test, I'm going to study hard and I'm going to do well in this test, and I've studied hard, so I should get a good mark, that is all conditioning. Now, when I told this story at the monastery and there were nurses and doctors and people with a medical background there, they said, well, of course it was the blood group. What do you expect? That's what they put up in a hospital. Because that's what doctors, nurses, pharmacists are used to seeing on blackboards in hospitals, not marks for the tests that the patients have gone through. Now, this kind of story makes us think how we are distorting reality according to our conditioning, according to how we think things are. Not only the fact that it should be considered to be a test that we've got to pass, but even the fact that one person thinks natural childbirth is better, deserves a higher mark, all that effort, whereas the other person thinks, how foolish to go to all that effort and all that trouble and through all that pain when medical science has spent years and millions of dollars developing just the kind of drugs we need. How stupid not to take advantage of that. Just a different view and opinion. And if we don't understand that we all have our different views and opinions, which inform our reactions and our perceptions and our emotions, we can't understand why this person's got it wrong. Obviously, this is the way it is. This is what I think. This is what I feel. It must be right. So just to understand to this extent that each one of us is reacting individually, even to the same kinds of situations. The trigger is outside, but the reaction is within us, And each one of us will have a different reaction. And isn't that the frustration we feel when we get so upset about something and the person that we're with couldn't care less? We get angry because they're not caring as much as we are. We forget about the original topic that we're upset about. We get upset with the person who's not getting upset with us. And this is how difficulties develop and snowball, and eventually we end up having an argument and we forget what it was we were even having an argument about. It's just an argument. So from the wisdom perspective, this is the first thing that the Buddha wants us to understand for our own well-being. And this is the second thing from a wisdom aspect that we also need to understand, that these strong emotions harm ourselves first of all. Before they harm anyone else, they harm us. We are the victims of our own powerful emotions. Unless we understand this, we are not going to be willing to do something about it. We're not going to be willing to work on our own inner stuff, because we're first of all going to think that our problems are caused by things out there, and that whatever we're feeling we should put out and let others know about, we should act on, because we're going to get something out of it. But the Buddha says, no, be aware that these reactions aren't caused from outside, they're from inside, and that when they are present because of their effect on the mind, they cause harm. And so we need to do something about them. And if we just take anger as an example of a strong emotion, anger is unpleasant, but it also energizes. And so very often we like to get a little bit angry, because that makes us get things done. We go out and do things that we couldn't be bothered doing other times. We say things that we mightn't have the courage to say at other times because we're angry. And this is the seductive power of anger, to make us feel that if I'm not angry, I won't be able to get into action, or I won't be able to stand up for myself. So we need to reflect what anger actually does to the mind. And as I said earlier, when any of these powerful emotions are present in the mind, they make it very difficult for us to think clearly. They limit our ability to react, because when we can't think clearly and see what is appropriate in this situation, and maybe to take into account some of the conditions or various influences that are operating in this situation, we just act on automatic pilot. We just act according to our conditioning, to our usual way of doing things. So we actually rob ourselves of any flexibility, of any innovation in our response in that moment. And so if that's the first thing that we need to really understand. And anger is a very good example of this, because we know how difficult it is to act in a flexible way when we're really angry. The next thing the Buddha said to reflect on is that when anger is present in the mind, that it makes us look ugly. And if we rarely see ourselves when we're angry, we're usually angry looking at someone else. But if you encounter someone who's angry, if you're on the receiving end, you know that even the look of that person is unpleasant. And the Buddha said, if you're thinking about the effect of anger on the mind, and you think of it as a friend, something that gets you going, helps you get to achieve what you want to achieve, then you're looking at it in the wrong way. Anger is actually an enemy and does to us what our enemies would like to see happening to us. Our enemy would like to see us looking ugly, not to see us looking beautiful. And that's what we do to ourselves when we get angry. And if you are good at getting angry, if you make it a habit and you practice it, then even when you're not angry, the lines that are worn into the face stay there. And you look angry even if you're not in a bad mood. And if you've done that for a lifetime, you can't even get rid of those that angry scowl with the best of cosmetics or any kind of beautifying. And so that's the first thing that we do to ourselves when we're angry. The second thing the Buddha said is that if you had an enemy, they wouldn't want you to be in good health. And if we are habitually angry, then we end up making ourselves sick. And when the Buddha was talking about anger as a defilement in the mind, he described it as being like a bilious disease. When we're angry, the body is in a heightened state of arousal. The systems are on alert. And all sorts of biochemicals are being pumped through the system in order to cope with the stress that we're encountering. But if we don't allow our anger to subside and we become used to being angry, then we never allow the body to return to a state of equilibrium. We operate always on that heightened state of alert, and eventually that starts to take its toll on the physical body. So people get blood pressure, they get palpitations, they have churning stomachs, tight muscles, all the sorts of chronic discomforts which come with that state of arousal. And the Buddha said that's doing what an enemy would want for you, that you don't have good health. An enemy would also like us not to have a good night's sleep. And when we are continually angry, it's very hard to get to sleep at night. And even if we're only angry every now and then, we can notice the effect that it has on our sleeping patterns, particularly when we go to sleep or go to bed at night without making any effort to shed that anger before we lie down. We take the anger with us into our dreams. The mind isn't able to go to a deep state of rest. And we wake up feeling tired. And very often we feel that same irritation that we felt as we were going to bed. And of course, if we don't sleep well, then we can't function as well in the day. Now, interestingly enough, one of the effects of loving kindness practice, and particularly going to bed practicing loving kindness, falling asleep with loving thoughts, is that one goes to sleep easily, one dreams no evil dreams, and one wakes happily. So this is the complete opposite to what happens to us when we go to bed with angry thoughts. So particularly if we've been involved in something during the day which has really upset us, we should recognize that carrying this anger with us to bed is going to harm us. It's not going to harm the person that we're angry with. They might be out dancing, and we're going to bed to have a sleepless night. So the first thing we need to do is to be aware of that harm and to make a deliberate effort as we get into bed, while we're in bed, to let go of those angry thoughts and to generate wishes of friendliness, of goodwill towards ourselves. So the kind of practice that we did this evening in the meditation, tuning into the physical body, if we've had an angry encounter, if we're carrying that with us, we will be able to locate that in the body. We'll be able to feel the tight shoulders. Maybe we'll feel the tension in the jaw. Maybe we'll feel the slight headache. We might feel the knot in the stomach. So as we're lying in bed, we go through the body and just allow our attention to rest on those parts and deliberately relax them. Just doing that much is an act of loving kindness. And as we do that through the whole body, we'll find that as we relax the body, naturally the mind will start to relax. When the body is tense, it has an effect on the mind. When the body relaxes, it has an effect on the mind. And as well, when we are doing that and making the effort to do it, we're generating feelings of kindness in our own mind, so that has an effect on the body. The mind and the body are constantly interacting. And so we don't have to have a great gush of love, of loving kindness. All we have to do is to care enough about ourselves to take a few minutes to relax before we go to sleep. And if we continue to do this practice again and again and again, we will find that we go to sleep with that relaxed feeling, both mentally and physically. When we do this, and when we practice meditation, we see how interconnected the mind and the body are. And one of the things that we can notice when we're being mindful of how it feels when we get angry is that when we get angry, it produces unpleasant sensations in the body. Because of the biochemical reaction that is triggered, an unpleasant feeling naturally arises. And then what happens is we don't like that unpleasant feeling. And so we start to react with irritation to the way the body feels. And we start to get angry with anger, if you like, with the effects of anger. We think that we're still getting angry at the person or the situation, but the unpleasant state that is aroused is itself another trigger for our continued irritation. This is something we have to discover for ourselves, and we discover it through meditation practice, or we discover it through trying to do that relaxation practice and offering ourselves loving kindness before we go to sleep. We see how the mind and the body are continually interacting, and once the body starts to relax, the mind naturally relaxes. So when we're getting angry in our daily life, we take a moment to pay attention to how it feels. And the feeling in the body will often persist because we've put into motion a series of causes and effects that takes time to play themselves out in the body itself. And as we notice that, we'll notice how that feels and how we don't like that. And that don't like reaction in the mind triggers more internal reaction. So part of the practice that we do in meditation is learning to accept unpleasant feelings without moving to the next reaction of, I don't like this, have to get rid of this, this is terrible. We start to be able to accept unpleasant feeling is unpleasant feeling. And to maintain the balance of our mind, even when a reaction is playing itself out in the body. In that way, we don't multiply that reaction. We don't add to that action. We don't keep it going any longer than it would naturally do. Now, all of these reactions, all of these strong emotions will, of them, of their own nature, pass away. They will cease. They will run their course. If we don't do anything, they will do that. But we can't usually not do anything. we make them stay longer by reacting to them, by reacting to the reaction that's produced. So part of our practice is to learn to bear with the unpleasant feelings that are produced, to keep the mind balanced, and to allow nature to take its course. That is, for that mental reaction and that physical feeling to pass away. As well as making us sick and not allowing us to sleep and not being able to think clearly, getting angry all the time often means that we lose our friends. Who wants to be around someone who's on a hair trigger? We learn to avoid those people that we have to be on guard with, people that we can't trust how they're going to react. They might say something that's really nasty out of nowhere, or they might easily get upset. They can't put up with much frustration, so they get impatient if everything's not ready on time or just right. And in this way, people who are continually angry find that they don't have friends around them. And if it's someone that we can't avoid, someone that we're working with or someone that's part of the family, we still find ways not to include them, to avoid them as much as possible. And so this is one of the effects of being perpetually angry, that again we harm ourselves in the relationships that we have with others. And the last of the things the Buddha said we should reflect on, well, not the last, one, the second to last, is that we get a reputation for being angry, and that becomes what people know us as. We might be good at all sorts of other things, but our brief description is that angry person. And if you look around in the world, you'll see that there are people who can do all sorts of things very well, but very often they're known as that person that can't be relied on because they have a bad temper. They can't be relied on to see the job through because they get upset and angry, frustrated easily. And so if we're looking for someone to do something, we don't choose that person. So this lack of reliability is one of the consequences of being overwhelmed by our emotions. And then the last consequence of being angry all the time, the Buddha said, is that if you had an enemy, very often you wish that that enemy might go to hell. And the person who's angry all the time is sending themselves to hell. They're already in the hell realm by being constantly upset, constantly overwhelmed, constantly on fire with the heat of anger. And if we practice throughout this life responding with anger, getting good at being angry, then at the time of our death, we'll be angry because we're dying. This shouldn't happen. This isn't fair. Someone did something wrong and I'm about to die. And this might sound flippant, but that's the way the mind works. Whatever we practice in this life, whatever we do habitually, that becomes the tendency of the mind. So we even greet death with an angry mind, and that will lead to an unfavourable rebirth. So this is just the emotion of anger. And if we reflect on anger in this way, we can see what the Buddha was pointing to, that it harms us, even before it harms anyone else. And even if we're not thinking about anger, if we're thinking about desire, desire is very attractive. It seems to offer something. We're going to get something when our desire is fulfilled. But the Buddha said desire is the same. It overrides our sense of what is right and wrong. It makes it very difficult to think straight. And the delusion of desire is that the more we seek to satisfy our wants, the better we get at wanting. It's not that we come to the end of desire by giving in. And one of the similes the Buddha gave for this reality is, he said, having desire is not only like having a bucket with a hole in the bottom that you're constantly trying to fill, and the water is running out the bottom, but it's like someone with leprosy. Someone with leprosy has a sore which itches. And so to get relief from that itch, the person scratches the sore. And in scratching the sore, there's temporary relief. But what happens is that in scratching the sore, it breaks open the skin, and then the sore spreads. And then because we keep on scratching, it gets infected. And then we scratch more, and then it gets even worse. And instead of going away, the sore spreads, until eventually the scratching just makes things worse. And the only relief that can be found is to sit close to the fire, because the heat of the fire brings temporary relief. But because we have damaged the skin and it's no longer sensitive, the person gets closer and closer to the fire and ends up burning themselves. And the itch still doesn't go away. Now, when we have strong desire in the mind, we can feel that internal itch. I've got to have this. I want that. This is what's going to make my life complete. And so we go after that thing. And there is some temporary relief. Some temporary relief from that internal itch. But how long does it last? Even if we get what we want. If it lasts, why do we have to go and do it again? Why do we have to get the next thing? Why do we have to go to the next place? Do the next thing? Because the desire is not fulfilled through acting on it. The desire just gets bigger and bigger. And we know what we, when we look around today and see how big everyone's television screen is. It's like going to the movies. If you go into someone's house and see these huge television screens, they have to get bigger, they have to get louder, they have to get clearer, because we're not satisfied with the way it used to be. We thought black and white was great, and then colour was great, and then just to be able to stop it and rerun was great. But now we want to have an even bigger screen where we can make our own movies and be in the movies, and it never ends. And we take it for granted these days that we want to have this sort of thing. We've got to have this sort of thing. This is great. But it's just making the itch bigger, worse. And if we don't reflect in the way that I've been describing, is this for my benefit? Is this for my well-being? Am I able to think clearly when I'm full of desire? We will just think that because I want it, I should have it. We also find we come into conflict with each other because what I want isn't always what you want. What you want is silly, but what I want is really important. So we find ourselves in the same situation as with anger, that very often two people are seeing completely different situations because of our different conditioning, our different habit patterns. And if we don't understand our individual reactions, we will come into conflict. So the Buddha says when we recognize, first of all, that we live in our own world and my way isn't the only way and my emotions aren't necessarily right? We also then question, should I follow this emotion? Should I give into it? Should I act on it? And when we realize how conditioned it is, we might stop and say no, at least have a second thought about it. And when we ask ourselves the question, who's suffering? Is this for my harm or is this for my good? Is this going to really satisfy or is this just going to bring temporary relief and I'll just continue to act in this same way again because I've acted in this way this time and I'm acting in this way this time because of how I've acted in the past, then we will find ourselves continuing to play out these strong emotions and to be overwhelmed by them. So we have to see the harm and then we have to see the way out. Now I've been talking about the wisdom factor and also about what we understand from our meditation practice. The very simple practices that we do about bringing our attention into the present moment, tuning in to the physical body, tuning in to the mood of the mind, getting a much more complete and accurate picture of what's going on moment to moment in our life, in our own mind. And then being able to notice how impermanent those reactions are. Even the pleasant reactions that we have in meditation arise, stay for a while and pass away. The unpleasant reactions, the pain in the knee, the pain in the back, once you move, that goes. It's also impermanent. And the mind that is paying attention, that is trying to watch the breath or is with the pleasant feeling, also is impermanent, arises, passes away. And as we experience this in the meditation, we start to understand even my strongest emotion, even my strongest reaction is impermanent, arises, stays for a while, and passes away. My strongest reaction, my strongest emotion is a produced thing. It has no life of its own. It's not me. It's not mine. It's just part of the passing show. Now, when we experience this in our meditation and we see how true it is, then we can take that to our daily life. And when a strong emotion overwhelms the mind, we recognize it because we're paying attention to the thoughts, to the mood, and also to the way it makes us feel in the body. And then we remember, conditioned, not true, impermanent, and we don't allow it to dictate our reaction. When we practice in our meditation to continually let go of the thinking and direct our attention to the breath, we are developing that strength of mind which is necessary in daily life, in the middle of a strong emotional response, to let go of the thinking and put our attention where we want it. If it's on the physical body, if it's on the next thing that we have to do, if it's on something that will help to counteract the emotion that we're feeling, we start to be able to do that because we've developed that skill and that strength of mind in the meditation. And then the other consequence of practicing meditation regularly is that eventually we start to be able to generate that feeling of ease and peacefulness, that pleasant feeling from within the mind itself. And to be able to do that gives us the courage to let go of those unwholesome emotions, because we know for ourselves that it is possible to experience something that's better without having to resort to unwholesome, unskillful reactions. We have something better to turn towards. And if we cultivate that in meditation, eventually we will find that we take that with us into our daily life. And we have that as a support in the midst of even an angry reaction. We can turn our attention inward and we can generate that pleasant feeling, even the memory of that pleasant feeling. And that becomes, at that time, our refuge. That's what stops us from rolling in the anger or getting swept away by the desire. Waiting until that desire or that anger naturally subsides. We don't feed it, we remain balanced, and it passes away. So meditation practice is essential if we're going to deal with these emotions. Understanding their nature, seeing them for what they are, and then having the strength of mind and the skills to be able to counteract them. It's not that we're repressing them or suppressing them, pretending that they're not there. We know that they're there, we acknowledge them, but instead of seeing them as something that is good and for our help, for our benefit, we see them for what they are, that is, as our enemies. As I said at the beginning, each one of us has to work for our own salvation, and I hope for you that this teaching will have been of benefit for you, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana.